Welcome to a Champion's Journey podcast. I'm Matt Davidson. From an early age, I've had the privilege of learning from world champions and world-class performers, and I've always been fascinated by what drives them to the pinnacle of achievement. In this podcast, I'll interview high performers to learn more about the tactics and strategies which have helped them on the road to championship victory. The intent of a Champion's Journey podcast is to interview not only those who have stood on the top podium in arenas of high-level competition, but to learn from those who have conquered life's greatest challenges and have dared to live life on their own terms. Kurt Werner is a member of the U.S. 8-Way Formation skydiving team and is one of the original and founding members of one of the most successful 4-Way teams in history, Arizona Airspeed. With a skydiving career spanning just over four decades, Kirk has amassed an impressive list of achievements. He's a two-time 4-Way Formation skydiving world champion, four-time 8-Way world champion, and one-time indoor 8-Way world champion. At almost 57 years of age, Kirk is one of the most relentless people I know, and he's showing no signs of slowing down. His mental and physical toughness are otherworldly and are matched by very few of any age. Kirk has been an inspiration and role model for me since I was just 16 years old, and I'm honored to be his teammate on the U.S. team for the 2023 and 2024 competition seasons. Without further ado, Kirk Werner. All right, Kirk, welcome to the podcast. I appreciate you being here. It's been a long time coming. We've been talking about doing this for quite some time. So, yeah, it's cool. I want to start off with asking you how you got your nickname Savage and who gave it to you.
Well, it's my actual middle name. My father named me Kirk Savage Werner. He was, a Stalin accuracy competitor, and his nickname was the Animal. And I think that was somewhat of his prowess as an athlete, but I think more of it was, you know, crawling out of the bar at 4 o'clock and then being on the early morning load and still doing well, you know? So, but on my birth certificate, it's actually Kirk S. Werner, but my middle name is Savage. And when I was a kid, I hated it. I didn't, like it at all. And, it was an odd thing. And then as I, became a competitor, and then as people found out, they're like, that's really cool. And I'm like, it didn't go that way for me, when I was a kid. But now I appreciate it. And, I think, again, my dad was just, and still is a bit of a maniac, so.
Yeah, he is. It's been cool getting to know him a little bit better as we've been peace partners, yeah. Been working together on the team. I didn't know that about you. As long as, as we've been around each other, I didn't know that it was your actual middle name. So that's pretty crazy. So can you talk some about what, the situation with your dad and how you get started skydiving?
Yeah. So my dad opened a drop zone in 65. It was a club in Sparta, Illinois. And he started jumping in 60. And I was born in 66. My earliest memory was at the drop zone, and I was an only child, and we, were open just Saturdays and Sundays and as a club. And then I don't know if I have the exact date, but I think around 67, 68, he bought the drop zone outright, and it was Archway Skydiving Center. And St. Louis, Missouri was his market. And so it was just, a typical static line, one Cessna at first, then two Cessna 182s. And I just grew up, holding tension when I was big enough on, when they were packing student rigs, T-10s and 28 footers. And, was always in the airplane and, going on observer rides. And, when we would take the airplane somewhere, I was always flying, And so I was always around it my whole life. And then, when I turned 16, in late September, and that weekend was October 2nd of 82, and I made my first static line jump. And they put me on a 28 footer, and I was still a little guy. I was probably like 125 pounds, junior in high school. And, but I still landed, so hard. And I remember going through high school that week, like both my ankles were kind of sprained, and I'm running up steps like, oh man, So, So I continued on, and you know, was making some jumps on rounds, and you know, you probably made jumps on rounds, and it's a very different experience. Yeah. You know, you have a lot more controlless feeling to it. So, and that was, we were going into the winter, so I wasn't, you know, super keen on, you know, that controlless feeling. And that was about the exact same time that we got squares were coming out for students. Like, I think Roger Nelson was already doing it in Sandwich. And the company that was Django, they made GlidePath. And then they had a special that you could buy. If you bought one canopy, they'd give you another one for free. So you're buying it for half price. And they only, but only let each drop zone could only do that one time. So Dad bought two squares and then had another drop zone there. They weren't going to do that. So we bought their two squares. And so we had four square canopies. And then from that point, I just started taking off. You know, I went total static line progression, 5 second delays, 10 second, went right to 10 second delays, no altimeter yet. And then 15 second delays. You got a, you know, had an altimeter on your belly mount.
Oh, wow.
And so, so my first free fall, my 5 second delay, all my tens were not great, you know, and just really wanting to get the ripcord out, you know, getting the ripcord pulled. So then once I got a 15 second delay, I'll never forget that jump. I was over over the city pool of Sparta, which was, you know, out by the drop zone, and I remember getting out and just like, you know, man, I'm starting to really pick up speed. I'm stable. You know, and I was like kind of right over the pool and, you know, opened. And then from that point, I just took off. And I worked the drop zone. That was 82, 83, 84. You know, graduated high school in 84. And just kept, you know, working at the drop zone. And then in around 86, 87, I'd always paid attention to the competition, the Golden Knights, of course, the DeLand guys, Tommy Pyrus, Guy Manos, who had won the 85 World Meet, Joe Napudi, and John Robbins. And, you know, I kept up on it. And my dad, who was flying at Muskogee at the Nationals in the 80s from 80 to 89, he was, you know, same thing, you know, hanging out at Fat Jack's Saloon every night. So he knew everybody, and therefore I ended up meeting everybody. And I was, you know, an up-and-coming jumper at that time, but I wasn't competing. I was just there, you know, at the Nationals watching, you know, my dad fly. He was flying. And so about 87, I wanted to, you know, I said, hey, I'm going to form a four-way team. And that was, I think that was late 87. We were kind of just dabbling in it. And then 88 rolled around, and I formed a team with at first with a guy on the staff, Dan Wright, a guy on my staff, Sam Johnson, also was a high school friend, and Don Thomas, and
was
Sean.
Was that Magnet Men?
Magnet Men. Nice. And that was Sean Capagreco on video. Yeah.
That's awesome. And if I can pause you there just for a second, I want to go back a little bit and talk about your relationship with your dad. I know mine, he was very, very good about, you know, talking with me about the safety aspects of stuff,
sure,
and just making sure that, you know, I was good on all my procedures, yeah, landing patterns and, you know, things like that. And he was really good for me as far as that goes. Was your dad the same way?
Yeah. 100%. He was there, you know, and at that time, even downsizing wasn't even a thing yet. You know, I mean, a small parachute was a 170. I mean, it was a very small parachute at that time. I jumped a 288, I think that thing was, for 1,000 jumps, maybe.
Wow.
Yeah, 1,000 jumps. And, but yeah, he was absolutely right there. And I, you know, at the beginning, I think like any parent, you know, the dangers of skydiving, and you're like, you know, this is, you know, I'm having that with my own son right now, Trey.
I'm
just like, you know, I'm like, you know, and same thing. I'm just, look, you take this slow, you know, learn the process, learn the equipment, all the things. And yeah, my dad was really, really on me and taught me a lot of things about, you know, surviving, you know, exit separation, everything, you know, just so many things, you know, out there. And so, yeah, he was similar to you. I'm sure that he was, you know, trying to keep me inside of a a safety circle as much as you can, you know?
Right. Yeah, my dad was, I was super fortunate to have that, you know, because I think, looking at a lot of students coming up, if they don't have that kind of, constant attention, sometimes they can kind of stray off a little bit and, get in accidents or whatever. And on that, I remember my dad, bringing me over when I first started jumping out at Rayford. He brought me out to the Paul Keith Memorial. Uh-huh. And he was like, he stood there with his arms crossed and he was like, read that. So I read it and he was like, you do that to me, I'll fucking kill you.
That's fantastic, man. Yeah, and growing up in Scott, I think too, you see all the negative side of people getting hurt. And I think that's actually good. You know, you have to understand that, this is a very serious sport. It's made as safe as possible by the participants, but it's very dangerous. And it's not a safe sport that we make dangerous. You know, it's already dangerous. So understanding that's super important. You know, I think you have to understand your own mortality inside this, and it keeps you safe, you know?
For sure.
Again, making sure that you don't go fast this way. You know, you can go fast this way, but not this way, you know? So, that came up later with my father as hook turns started happening. He was not happy DZO about that, you know? But
It was interesting to hear you say that you're having some issues on your 5-10 second delays, because I did as well. I was just telling the story to somebody the other day where, with the rip cord, I couldn't figure out why I had why I had my risers, were twisted whenever I came down. Mm-hmm. And then one day I had a friend who was taking pictures. Once he developed the pictures, I could see that I was sticking my legs out as I pulled. So, and I was like, oh yeah, that's right. I remember watching the canopy open to my feet. So I was flipping through my risers.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I was, I was only, moderate student. I wasn't nothing special for sure.
But that's cool, because I think for myself and for a lot of people that, look up to you and look up to other high experience jumpers, it's good to know that, we've had our struggles along the way too.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you and I both are very similar in a sense of we put a lot of work in, and that's, I think, what it boils down to. That's what makes you good at anything, and a good competitor is doing it a lot, and putting yourself out there. And I think that's it as well, making the risk, you're going to go do something and look potentially stupid, and we know that training together and flying together, that's just part of it, man. You're going to have those things. And so you have to get in there, kind of jump in with both feet,
Yeah, for sure. So before I interrupted you about, kind of your how you got into the competition.
Yeah. So I was really looked up to, Tommy Pyrus and Jack Jeffries. At that time, it was Mark Harrington. And, I'm brain locking who the fourth was. I believe it was maybe Dan Thompson at that time, on that team, and from DeLan. And maybe DeLand Gang. So I hired him. I called Tommy to hire him, and he's like, "Look, I'm overbooked, but I want you to, why don't you use Mark Harrington?" So I've used Mark, and it was fantastic. The typical thing, teaching you basic body flight, basic setups, nothing that you had really heard before. Talked about body position, that you had balance. And so we used Mark for a while, and Tommy was already there, always there, and kind of looked in. And then,
what were the things that you were teaching about body position at that time? Because it's evolved quite a bit since.
Box span, making sure that you could see your hands, and people were flying with their arms back, and myself included. So just they wanted balance of pushing air off the lower and upper body equally, and seeing where your hands were all the time. Because, if you try to take a side body and you're already back here, you get floaty, right?
Right.
So we used Mark, and he was fantastic. And then as the team went on, won the conference meet, and we were kind of trending up a little bit as a weekend team. We were making 150 jumps a year. And then I had talked to Jack and Z Hills, and it was kind of out there that, hey, this guy is, he's the future. He's super good, you know, way above everybody else, you know, everything. He was just really kind of seemed like he was supernatural at it. And was a very good athlete outside of skydiving, you know. And so once we hired Jack and we replaced one team member, then we just started taking off because we were doing really well. We could tell we were probably doing like maybe 11 or 12 average, you know, something in there. I think the world meet was being won with about a 15 average at that time by the French team tag. And so from there, at the 1990 U.S. Nationals, we had two things happen. We had a guy, get hurt, and so Jack was going to jump for him because Jack wasn't doing a team that year, and he was our coach, so he's like, "Yeah, I'll jump with you," and then. One of my other teammates, Don Thomas, he hooked in at the Nationals, and which he was kind of doing this a lot at that time because this is when hook turns were coming out, and he thumped in off the ground, and we were just like, oh, you know, what else can happen here to us? And
was he injured to where he couldn't jump anymore?
Well, he was in a cast, and he went to Casa Grande, and they put him in a cast, and he's like, I'm jumping. And dude, he did. He jumped in a cast. And we had a pretty good meet. We did with Jack in there. It certainly elevated us. And we were third place in the open division for a weekend team, which was, you know, the Gumbies had done it. They were second, I think, 1 year. And of course, Dan's team, Green County Fusion, you know, they were a little bit on the more professional end. We had made like 200 jumps. But we had got good coaching. And then so from that point, that's about the time that I met Dan BC and we were doing 20 way together. So I was that team, the Magnet Men, I think some of the gold, no, I'm not sure if it, maybe the Golden Knights and, it was the Golden Knights and, Dan's team, Air Moves. So we did 20 way together and that's where I kind of really, you know, started talking with Dan and knowing Dan personally, you know, and then after that 92 or 91 meet, I was just kind of floating around, you know, I don't even think the Magnet Men were continuing. And at in April of 92, the Paris Otter crashed. And, of course the Team Air Moves was on there and Dan, several of them were on there. Were on there and lived. And then of course, James Lane died in that accident, tragically. And among other people, you know, and other teams from other countries that were on there, it was just an unfortunate wake-up call for the industry. You know, we brought seatbelts in. That's right. When seatbelts started, you know, and all of it, you know. So little did I know that was going to change my whole directory. And Dan was out recovering. They were trying to put Air Moves, they were trying to put Air Moves back together and have a showing at the 92 Nationals, which was in Eloy. And Dan had to go back and get a surgery. So he called me and he said, hey, would you come out here and jump for me for like the month? And, you know, we'll keep you on as an alternate and everything. And so I was like, well, and I didn't, for some weird reason, I didn't just jump on it. I actually called Jack and I was like, hey, because I was, you know, of their school a little bit, you know what I mean? And I said, you know, what do you think of this? And he said, I think it'd be really good for you. You need to get rounds, you know, and whether you get to jump or not, you know, it'd be good to go out and look at it. So I called Dan back. I said, look, I'll come do the month. And Dan tells me all the time, he's like, I knew I had you. Once you got there, I knew I was going to get you. So I went out there and I had a fantastic experience at Scott of Paris with the Knatzer families. And that team was a very good experience. I was starting to learn. I was around very good people. And I was learning things at an incredible rate because my environment was sterile. And so then rolls around. Dan ends up, you know, recovering enough that he just kind of slotted in at the Nationals amongst the five of us. I don't know what the numbers were, but you know, we, you know, all of us took a turn out, and we were having some pretty good jumps. And I was slated to stay at Paris and stay on Air Moves. I mean, I, you know, talking with the Canatsers, and you know, they, you know, were happy to have me there, and I was going to cut away from my home drop zone and do that. Well, at the 92 Nationals, the Florida team won, beat us. So they were the U.S. team, which was Jack, Trey Johnson, Craig Buxton, and Mark Hewitt.
What was the name of that team?
That was DeLand Heat. DeLand, okay. No, Vertical Speed.
Okay.
Vertical Speed, yeah. And that was and they were good. They were great, man. They were super disciplined. Jack and Tommy was looking at them, and they were really good. And so fast forward a little bit. I'm in Paris, and we're kind of just letting it cool down after the thing. And I get a call from Jack, and he says, "Hey, listen, we're gonna replace somebody. Would you come to Florida and go to the world meet," which was in Eloy in 93. And I said, and my first words were like, "Can we win?" And he's like, "No, but the experience is going to be necessary for you, for what you need. You got to have 10 rounds at the world meet, you know?" So I did. And I went to Dan and I told him what was happening and the team and the Canatsers. And they were, you know, it's nerve wracking when you're, you know, doing something like that. And they were just like nothing more than supportive, you know, like, "Look, we totally get it. And if it was me, I'd be going," you know?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. They were really good. Really great. So go to Florida, start training with that team for the 93 meet. You know, another very good experience, really good. And then of course, you know, jumping with, one of my idols, Jack, you know, as my coach, and, you know, it was very surreal at that point. So putting in the work, you know, we go to the meet in 93 and, the French are handing it to us. You know, they're handing us. I think they beat us by 7 or 8, which is a lifetime, you know, at the end of it all. But it was a very good experience, you know, that I needed those 10 rounds. Well, all this time, Dan's coaching several teams at the World Meet. He drives over from Paris. And what most people don't know is that Jack and Dan were rivals. And there was very little communication between those two. And anything that I ever saw when I was on the teams, or, you know, in 92, I learned what Dan was saying and what Jack had been telling me and everything, like their coaching styles. Anything that I saw between them was kind of like jab, you know what I mean? A little bit of a jab, you know? And so, but they were East Coast versus West Coast. And
I want to pause you right there. I want to go back a little bit to your experience, you know, against the French. And you said, you know, you definitely learned some things there. What were some of the things that you learned specifically?
Well, I think one is that, you know, a round at a world meet is one of the most intense things that I've ever, I mean, no base jump that I ever did had really anything on it. And I was doing very vanilla base jumps. You know, they were nothing very technical, but still, you know, still a stressful skydive, and but nothing like a world meet. So I learned how to, you know, kind of control that monster that tries to get you, you know, as you're
managing the stress.
Yeah, just, you know, making sure that, you know, all the little things that, you know, we were logging and journaling every round. And
okay, I was about to ask, like, how you manage that.
So we had a sports, site guy that was with us and carried on with us into Airspeed right after that, and unbelievably valuable. You know, he just taught us how to manage with each other, you know, because at the end of it, even with Airspeed, the original lineup, there was a lot of times people would always say, "Oh, you guys are so great. You're like the best friends." I'm like, man, it's not like that at all. But we had a very professional relationship from 9 to 5, where we held each other in unconditional high regard from 9 to 5. But we didn't go out and have beers that much together. You know, Jack was off rock climbing. Dan was, you know, had a family and babies. And
I imagine whenever you get, you know, that many alpha type personalities, you know, locked together, especially, you know, I think there's different levels to those alpha type personalities, but man, you guys all, you know, definitely have that. And I would imagine there'd be some clashes along the lines there.
And we had an outlet to figure it out. You know what I mean?
And was that a Dr. John?
That was Dr. Bob Moore.
Okay.
Yeah. Dr. John only worked with us a little bit, like way later. Okay. But yeah, Dr. Bob Moore. Mm-hmm. He was a Scott Ever from Vermont. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and fantastic. Did great work with us. He's a big part of it. You know, like I said, like if you had whatever that was bothering you, you can compartmentalize it, put it away, and knew you had a vehicle to address that at the end of the day or at the end of when we had Pastor Rock or whatever okay. It was. So you could not just, you know, blow up right then, which has happened on many of the other teams I had. You just kind of shut your day down because, you know, two people are getting into it and or you are. But at that 93 meet, Dan was like, hey, what are you guys doing after this? And I realized because of the 92 and then before that with Tommy and Jack and Mark Harrington, Dan and Jack were saying the exact same thing. There was nothing like one technique at all. But the only one thing at that time was that Jack was absolutely attacking any kind of personal issues that were going on there. And I think sometimes with air moves and Dan and my experience was that we're going to just not avoid it, but just not attack it. Right. And because once we got into that system with Dan, Jack, myself and Mark, we were all into attack of everything. We didn't let anything slide by, you know what I mean? So I think it was just a vehicle through Dr. Bob Moore that Jack had, you know, that was a little bit of the difference. So anyway, Dan was like, I don't want to talk to you. I'll talk to you when we get done. But we were talking every day and we were talking about, hey, let's join these two things. And he was like, well, what's Jack think? And I'm like, I don't know. You know, you can ask him. And I just kept telling him, hey, you're saying the same things. There's nothing new. So, right after we got done with that meet, Dan had an old, I think a Ford, blue Ford van, big long van, no windows in it. And Jack and Dan and I sat in that van, and that was this October of 93. And we said, we're going to build a super team. And so we looked at, we wanted 700 jumps, pay the cameraman, I think $8 or $10, and pay for pack jobs for $700. And pack jobs were $350. Yeah. So, and that's what we asked for. So we were into land, Jack and I, and Bob Hallett didn't own the airplanes, and I think Free Fall Express owned them. So Free Fall Express came back and said, we didn't have a team yet, said, we'll give you $400, and but not $750. And Paris, we asked Paris, and Paris was like, hey, we're in litigation over this crash. We can't do anything right now. We're sorry. And Larry Hill was like, I'll give you unlimited and a place to stay. And, you know, I'll give you, you know, trailers to live on here. And da, 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 da.
That's awesome.
And so we're like, we're going to Arizona. But we held the tryouts in December of 93 in DeLand. We opened it up. A lot of people ask, can I try out? And we opened it up to, you know, maybe like six or seven people. And everybody did really well, you know. But Mark was just, he was with Dan the year before, and he was just the obvious choice. And then John Lemming was the guy that we were just going to take him as video anyway, because I grew up with him and we liked each other, we all liked him. So, we formed it right there and then went to Eloy January of 94, and we just got to it. I mean, we were getting ready for the Valentine's Day meet, and nobody had broken a 20 average at that point, and that was one of our goals. We wanted to break a 20 average. And I think at the Valentine's Day meet, we did like a 19-1, which is good. We were ripping. But I think as well, the Valentine's Day meet, the Golden Knights I think that maybe was the next year. They beat us at that meet, and one of the few meets that we lost. But it was to the Golden Knights at the, I think, the next year's Valentine's Day meet.
And is that like Paul Rafferty, Craig Girard?
I think the Scooter was on there. Okay. I think Scott Rhodes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they just were laying it on us, you know, because they didn't give a shit. And, you know, they were, and we needed it. But at any rate, so we just started training, and we went to the 94 World Cup. And I'll never forget, you'll appreciate this, that we had that thing where we started doing math, right? So you're getting close, and we wanted a 20 average. We were putting it on the French. We were laying it on them a little bit, kind of what they were doing to us in 93. We had 7-8 points on them, and we were just outpacing them, you know? And I remember Mark comes in and is like, hey, guys, if we get like a 17 on this last round, we're going to break a 20. And everyone's like, no, don't say any numbers, you know? Well, of course, we go up there and we do a 16. And we had a 19-9. And, you know, again, we were all thinking about it. So, and then we went to the 95 World Meet in Gap, France, the next year, and we did a 20.7 and beat the French by 2. You know, awesome. they were tough, man. They were super tough.
I want to pause you there for just a second. Yeah. What's your philosophy as far as, you know, looking at scores, knowing scores? I know what it is now, but if you were talking to a relatively new team, what would be your guidance, you know, for them as far as that goes?
As much as you can, stay away from it. You know, like, look, you need to know what you scored because you need to know what the judges are looking at. And if they don't like, you know, whatever it is, if they don't think you're, you know, taking proper grips, or you need to understand that so that you can adjust if you need to. But man, stay away from it. It's going to be torture because each round is its own competition. It's its own world meet, really. And all you can control is that next round. And you get, we always joke, if you're at the scoreboard with a calculator, you're not in the right headspace. Like, just understand what your score is. I think more importantly, and all these scoring systems do this, is when you know your pace, right? So you can go up on a jump and you can score a 20 and they score a 20. But when you look at the video, they just scored 20 and we were about to be on 21. You know what I mean?
Right.
So you know, hey, I'm outpacing them. No matter what's happening, we're outpacing them, you know? So, like we had that at the world meet in Russia recently with that fast 8-way round, and we had looked at our jump already. And then, you know, we had done a 32 to a 31 on a fast jump. And I remember watching the scoreboard, watching the French who were, you know, I mean, super dangerous for us. They were just, we was back and forth and trouncing us sometimes with a lot of points. And I looked at the clock, like, man, halfway. I'm like, man, we're way ahead of them. Like, unless they accelerate, you know, and then you're like, okay, now we have that ability to outpace them that much, you know. It's a confidence booster.
I was
you
about
know?
To say, yeah, so that that helped give you some confidence.
Yeah. So I think that's an important thing. Away from the scoreboard, but understand what your pace is. Like, know that, hey, I'm beating those guys on pace, even though the score might be alike, and they know it.
Right.
So you know what I mean? You have to, I think, use that to your advantage a little bit.
Yeah, then it works the opposite way. Then it's a confidence hit for them. And
Yeah, for sure. You know, I've been on both ends of it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. So let's go back to, I'm trying to remember what year of meet that we were talking about before.
The 95 one, okay, 95 right. Gap. And then we came back, and about that time, I think around that time, Craig Girard got out of the Army, and of course, we were, you know, all very good friends with Craig, a wonderful human, as you know.
Craig's great.
And so we started talking about forming an 8-way team. And Larry Hill was all about it. He really wanted us to do 8-way. So we hired Craig, or Scott of Arizona really did, and said, and I guess Airspeed too, like, hey, you help us form this team. You teach us what you know. And it was a cool thing because then I got saturated into the Golden Knight world. You know, I was like, whoa, there's a lot of information here, you know. But as well, because the Golden Knights outside of the World Meet had really not been had anybody pushing them that much. Even at the World Meet, they really had a little bit here and there, the French team in 1 year. But they were pretty much putting it on them, right? I think that our mentality around our 4-way team, how we were, you know, very aggressive style, you know, a lot more aggressive and less smooth, maybe. I think bringing that to what that was made this hybrid. I think that it is still here today in our team, you know, that we have this, you know, that right amount of being calm enough to make good decisions and aggressive enough, that balance.
Right.
And You know, and the Golden Knights certainly had that thing. Like I said, they beat us at that meet because they just went full power on like when they went to four-way, because they were like, what do we care? We're just going to spin this stuff. And you can't forget that, you know, because you can get too technical about things and, you know, you start trying to, you know, red flag all this little stuff, and somebody like the Golden Knights come along and they just go right by you, you know, because they're just like all thrust, you know, no rudder. So
that's been my approach, and I wanted to talk with you about that too, as far as you know, not getting so in the weeds about the technical aspects and over talking things, and relying somewhat on your intuition and your instinct, and you know, how that really affects things. Because I mean, skydiving is a lot of feel, and it's, while it's good to know the structures and the latest techniques, and you know, there is definitely those elements of, hey, we just need to feel this out and fly it. And I just wanted to to hear your thoughts on that.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's just, there's a balance, right? It's a balance, and each team's different. That sometimes you have teams that are very analytical, you know, and they need that. They need that information of why, you know. And other teams are, you know, maybe a little bit more feel, you know. I think we're experiencing that, you know, with our eight-way lineup. We're having a lot of technical talk, but there's a lot of feel in there, you know, that you can just kind of know. And you and I have it as peace partners, where there's a lot of feel, you know, for you and I, of like our timing and everything. So I think it's, I think a both. I think importantly, even for us, you know, we've talked about this, that having someone come in and look at you over the top of you, like stand over you while you're trained for, you know, a 5-day camp is great. You know, old teammates, Brian Krause, you know, Dave Flynn from the Knights, you know, looking over us, all that's really good. And I think even more than that, you bring in a guy from the 2020 team, Nicholas or Mikhail, because then they're not emotionally attached. Right. They can look very objectively. Okay, this looks messed up, or this looks, you know, off. And it's hard when we're in there and, you know, we're emotionally attached to the performance, our own and the team's, and it can be it can get modeled, I think, a little bit. So yeah, I like what, you know, certainly what Nicholas and Mikhail brought to the 2020 team. You know, I really like that a lot, and I think it helped us win. And
it's one of the things that I respect, you know, about you a lot, is that, you know, you're one of the most experienced guys on the planet as far as formation skydiving competition goes. And you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but you might be one of the most experienced guys on the planet with skydiving in general.
Yeah.
But you're still able to have a level of humility to where, you know, you want that outside view. And when we're working together as peace partners, you're really good about, if I ask, you know, something, oh yeah, sure, you know,
yeah,
you know, I'll definitely do that. And I try to do the same thing with you, but I really respect that about you. And, wanted to kind of know your philosophy about that, and whether that's something that you've always had or something that you've had to work on.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've worked on it a little bit too. You know, but I've said forever that I want to be a lifelong learner. I think that you're just going to get passed up, you know, if you're not willing to, you know, look at stuff. And I think the hardest thing for guys like you and I who have done this so long is when we get an actual new person in. And I've had that with Gina, you know, not anymore, but at the beginning, and not just Gina, but anybody new. And it's sort of like, you know, if you're really good at chess, that a new person, like if they ask, well, what about this? What about this engineering? And I already know where it's going to end up. But you don't want to just shut that down.
Right.
You got to let them, no, that's not it. Let's just move on. That's worse than just, okay, think about it, let it go through. And they're like, okay, yeah, it doesn't work. And you're like, yeah, that's right, it doesn't work. But instead of shutting them down, and sometimes those stuff, the old things that didn't work, they can come back on a new team and you can use it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, we've how many things have gone full circle in the four-way dive pool, technique-wise? I mean, Zigzag Marquee has done a million different things where it steps out and, you know, now we just spin and,
right,
you know what I mean? I think it all does boil down to the group a little bit, because if you look at engineering with, you know, how the French and the Russians and the Belgians do things and how the U.S. does things, it's different, but they've all won, haven't they? So, you know, anything will work if everybody's bought into it.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah, you've done that with me several times, too, where I've, you know, come up with something engineering-wise, and I can kind of tell in your demeanor sometimes where you're like, all right, I'm gonna hear this through, but, you know, I've thought it through, too, and I know where this is going to end up, and if I haven't thought about it completely, then I'll be like, oh, yeah, that's not going to work here, and then we kind of move on.
But I think we need those out there. Right. Otherwise, we'll get stuck, you know?
Yeah, like, for sure.
We'll do things one way, and, you know, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Because I think 8-Way's got so much further to go, you know, there's so much improvement there. Launching a first point at some point down the road, you know, that saves you, you know, 4 seconds, 3 seconds, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of been a friction point with us from time to time, because we've, you know, that's been an ongoing conversation. I know with the Knights, we, with Mike LaRoche, you know, we just sat there and we timed everything as far as the standard exit. You know, to the first and second point, you know, sometimes launching that first point's definitely faster out the door. But, you know, what angle are you going to be, you know, out the door or on the hill? And how is that going to affect the time between, you know, the next point and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
And some of those numbers we're still trying to figure out. But I think you're right, you know, that the higher level of training that you can have with, you know, launching that first point as close as you can get it.
And I agree. I think sometimes, you know, you come off that exit, that 8-way exit, and it has a little spring to it when everybody does the right thing at the same time. And you almost use that energy to, like, launch into there. And, you know, just no matter who it is, the more launches you do, you're just naturally going to just start letting it go quicker, because everybody's going to be, you know, going to the right place. And, you know, that makes it faster as well. I think a big thing, like, even for our team this year is eventually getting a mic on the point face this way and Gina on the tail face opposite, so that they come off on E's and F's and they don't have no 180.
Right.
I think that's one thing that's pretty easy to do, and they can speed up maybe for next year. But
yeah, we've talked about that quite a bit, as far as, like, Eliana back there, you know, back on some of the 8-way teams.
Dennis Rook, too, diving front float on 19.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, him and Craig, you know, both diving, and it's super fast nice. To get to.
So I want to go back a little bit to around the time the 8-way formed. It was right around the time that I kind of came on to the competition scene finally, and, you know, such an incredible time for me. You know, it was a magical time. I remember watching, you know, just wearing out the VHS tapes
of
Airspeed, you know, watching you guys and looking up to you, and then finally able to, I think it was 96 was my first competition experience, but right around that time was when you know, started going out to Skydive Arizona, and it just seemed like a super magical time, as far as you had the you know, the free flying was starting to take shape. You had, like, guys like Olav Zipser and Omar Legolon and
Charles Bryan,
and I just wanted to know to look back and see, because the landscape has kind of changed now as far as military contracts and a lot of drop zones and that kind of thing. And it seems like that's taken away a little bit from the feel that it had then, when it was, you know, it was a lot of boogies and it was a lot of, you know, kind of, maybe there was a hippie culture, you know, with skydiving kind of thing. But it's just seemed like a magical kind of, you know, kind of a thing that was brewing at the time. And I was just wondering if you had the same.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, this sport changes, you know, quite dramatically. I mean, it's expensive, number one. It's an expensive sport. And so that changes the dynamic for people right away, you know, because you can't, I mean, anybody can do it, because if people really get into it, they'll figure the money part out. You know, it's not just, oh, I got this much money, so I'll do this. I'm doing this. I'll get a second job when I need to. I'll sell this, you know, I'll sell my car or whatever it is. You know, you can, I did that, you know, so you can figure out, you know, a way to do it if, you know, it means a lot. But I think that as well, like, in that time, like you said, there wasn't free flying, angle, you know, not hardly any, much wingsuit, right? A little bit. And so FS was the name of the game, you know what I mean? And there are a lot of people doing it too, you know, where there were just, like, seemed like a lot of teams. You go back and look at the number of teams at the Nationals, there's a lot more now. There's a lot more, right. You know, but I have the same thing where there was more like a grassroots, you know, thing at that time.
That's,
you know,
a good term for it.
Yeah. You know, the Muskogee Nationals was much more of the banquet was balancing a plate of barbecue over a keg as a guy's pumping your beer, you know, I'm at the Nationals, you know. And so, yeah, and I think all for the good way, because these other disciplines, you know, VFS, angle, all of it, fantastic stuff, you know, and seeing athletes do that, you know.
Canopy piloting, yeah.
Incredible stuff. And so it diluted us, you know, a little bit. So I think that's what I feel most out of the that time, was that we were all kind of compacted into that one discipline, you know, and then it was, so now it's hard to branch out. Although I still see, you know, like VFS, of course, is FS. It's relative work. But even angle flying is kind of the same thing to me, that, look, we're being relative right now, you know, and canopy flocking, all that stuff. It's kind of the same thing. And that people are branching out and doing such incredible stuff is super cool, I think. And,
yeah.
And skydiving is a small club. And I think that's okay as well. You know, you don't, you know, I know that there's people over the years that wanted it to be as big as snow skiing. I don't think so. It's very dangerous. And again, we're making it as safe as possible. But, you know, there's already a lot of people in the sport that understand risk assessment, you know. Right. And so I think if you know, the whole it's safer than driving a car. Yeah, but everybody that's driving a car in Hope County right now went out and did a level one AFF. I'm pretty sure the fatality rate would go up just a little bit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think we're about perfectly sized, you know, honestly, and we can give people a very good quality. You know, they can learn to do it and do it safely, you know, and with the use of a wind tunnel and modern equipment and modern instruction. I mean, you know, you've seen our students at Paraclete and all these and drops on students now. They're really good. There's information for them everywhere. They can get on the internet, see videos. USPA does a great job, you know, with all of that. So I think there's a big part of it, you know, that I like the growth that way. But getting a lot more numbers, you know, I don't know that that's really the route that it'll go. I think it'll kind of stay here. People get into it, and then they get out of it. There's a bit of a high turnover rate, but you know, in the disciplines of the competitions, it's kind of the same people that we've known for, gosh, man, you know, 30 years or so.
Right.
You know? And,
yeah.
and new people.
Well, course. I think, you know, Scott at Paraclete XP does a really good job as far as, you know, maintaining a good balance between not only the contract stuff, but also the being team friendly and yeah. having the great facilities and the great coaches. They're at Scott at Paraclete XP, and I think that has a lot to do with you. You know, you've been very influential as far as that goes.
And I think my boss, Tim DeNunzio, listen, before I got here, I remember, you know, coaching the XP eight-way team, you know, before I came here. And how that just then his vision was like, hey, man, I've said forever, if I ever got money, I'm going to support competitive skydiving, and he's done exactly that in a huge way. I mean, just because he's bought into it. You know what I mean? It
means something to him. Who's also
John,
on our team,
yeah, all
you know,
of them.
He's incredible.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
The whole DeNunzio family, man, they totally understand that part, and it's a tough business. You know, there's the expense and airplanes. It's just out. It's crazy. You know, it really, really is. And certainly, military contracting, you know, helps that and helps a sport jumper. It lets them jump out of an airplane that they know is maintained properly. You know, Paris, Scott of Arizona, Scott of Chicago, all the people that are contractors, they, you know, you have to, and not just them. You have to do it anyway. You can't sacrifice safety for money in the sport. You can't. It'll
yeah.
get you, you know.
Definitely.
We got away with that in the 70s and the 80s, but yeah, I don't think anymore, you know.
Yeah. So backtracking a bit to when the eight-way team started to form for you guys.
So we formed that was late 95 into 96. We had the four of us, Craig, John Eagle, John Hamilton, and Gary Beyer. And I think we had Steve Nowak on video at that time. And this was the same thing with that scoreboarding thing. So it's at the ranch, and the weather wasn't great at the ranch. They just, you know, hit and miss a little bit. And we had that thing where we were not going to look at the scoreboard. That was our plan. We had to go on this whole year. We're not going to look at the scoreboard. And But it didn't matter because, you know, you get three or four rounds in and you're walking through the drop zone and people don't know that you're not looking at the scoreboard. And they're like, hang in there, man. It's not that bad. You'll get them, you know. And you're like, oh, it's bad. And so the Golden Knights were just putting it on us. And we just didn't realize. And they beat us up pretty good. And then we went back. I don't think we changed anyone yet. And we started training again for 97. They beat us again in 97. And then they had a big change. That was after the 97 World Meet. And they had a big of a rebuild. And, you know, civilian teams, all teams, are opportunist, you know. And when you see that, you know that, hey, they're a rebuild. They've got a long way. But the Golden Knights will absolutely put in the work. And you can't hold them to think that they're not going to perform well. They're going to perform well.
We were training hard those years. Yeah. That's when I came into the picture, 96 at the ranch. That was my first meet. I made the team the end of 95, and I was the alternate through 97. But, after 97, you know, is when we started that big rebuild.
Right. Well, Scott was gone. Scott was out. A bunch of those guys were out, right? So then at the 98 meet, We had a good meet, and you guys, I guess you guys, you were on that 98 team.
Yeah.
You didn't have a good meet. You had a couple of rough jumps at the beginning, I think, and we just stayed steady, you know. So then we went to, then from that point, we went to the 99 World Meet in Australia to do both events. We were going to do 4-way and 8-way, and it was, you know, it was just we diluted both too much, and the French, pretty much from the get-go, I think we were going like it was tying, but they were putting a point on us. We could kind of feel that the young guys, you know, Martial and his brother Marin, and I think it was Terry and Davide, I can't remember. It's been so many, but they were putting it on us a little bit. So, but with the 8-way, the Russians are who we were against, and We were doing pretty well against them, you know, halfway through the meet. About halfway through the meet, I didn't think so. I disagreed with this all year that we needed rest. I was like, come on, it's 20 jumps. But I didn't really factor in as 20 stressful jumps, right? And so the French had us by a couple points. So we were just trying to blaze through 4-way. And then in the 8-way event, our performance was going this way, and the Russians were doing this. And it was just a matter of time. Would those radials cross before round 10? And we beat them by a point. And we lucked out. So by doing both events, man, I learned a powerful lesson right there. It is a super incredibly hard thing to pull off. One guy's done it, you know.
Yeah, and I was there when we lost to him in 2010 in Russia.
Yeah, Mathieu. Yeah. Incredible, man. And at a super high level, you know, for him. So it will probably get replicated at some point, you know, but by four whole people, I'm not sure about that. It's a biggie, you know. So, and then from there, from after the 99 meet, then we were just cruising, man. Jack and Dan left. I mean, as far as 8-way, we kind of split into 2 4-way teams. And that's when Airspeed Vertical, Craig, Neil, John Eagle, and Andy Delk. Oh, Mark. Sorry, Mark.
Oh, right.
Yeah, sorry. Then they were starting to trounce everybody in the world, you know. And I was still doing 4-way on the other Airspeed team. And our 8-way was just kind of like, we went to the 2001 World Meet with one training jump, you know, and lost to the Russians. In the last round, they were same thing. They were just catching us, and we weren't skydiving very well. And then we went on to 2003, 2004. 2003 was gap. We won that meet. No, I take it back. We tied, but lost because we didn't have the highest round in 8-way. And then 2004 in Croatia, we won that meet with Chris Talbert. He came there and he was working at Paraclete, and we said, hey, can we use him for 4 months? And Tim was like, sure. And he came there and did a great job. He was so good. What we needed, you know, Todd had an accident, and we needed a pick-me-up, you know, and he brought all that, you know.
Nice.
And And then I went to 2006 World Meet in Guerra and lost to the French. And
I want to pause just a little bit and go back to, I think it was, you said 2004 to the, was that the one in Russia where you guys lost by a point because of the fastest round?
No, that was 2003 in Gap.
Yeah, France.
We lost to Russia.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a tie. We went to a jump off tied on 11 jumps and, but they had done like a 26. We had done 25. Like,
was that the meet where there was, I think Alan Metney was involved in trying to help to make sure that things.
That was 2001 in Spain.
Okay.
So that was at that military base out of Casas, and they had a terrible PA system. So something happened, and the Russians thought they were released for the day. Well, they weren't. We went up and made a round. They weren't there. And they gave them a zero. And so the Russians were arguing, like, hey, man, like, And in their defense, the PA system was horrible, you know, and I think we almost had the same thing where people, hey, don't leave, you know, somebody told us, but they didn't tell the Russians. So Alan was on our team, and he went into the rules and said, hey, look, by spirit of the rules, we think that they should get a rejump. And they gave it to him, and I think they should have gotten a rejump. I don't think that was fair. If they'd have just, like, left just because they were, you know, having an attitude. There was a lot of confusion at that meet anyway. And then they beat us, you know, in the last round. So, you know, we had only trained, like I said, a couple training jumps. And they were certain, this was the first world meet that they had won. And they had been trying for a long time. I mean, you know, you hate to lose the sword to somebody, and especially for the first time, but I was actually genuinely happy for them. You know, if I'd have put in a big training year, I probably wouldn't have felt the same way,
right.
You know, but I was just there, just, you know, we were holding jumps together, but they were just better than us.
Awesome that, you know, it showed such great sportsmanship that, you know, you guys helped facilitate, you know, their being able to do that.
For sure. And that's the right thing to do.
For sure.
Look, at the end of the day, it's all offense, right? There's no defense. You're just all putting out a performance. They're putting out a performance, and you just see how it lays out there. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Speaking of offense, I want to talk about your physical training
mm-hmm.
regimen, because you've made a huge transformation in recent years, and I want to talk about some of the first. How old are you?
I'm 57.
57, and man, you're in incredible shape.
I feel great.
And, but if you can just talk about what motivated you to make that change, and you know, your thought process, and then maybe if you can talk some about your you know, your actual physical training regimen.
So, well, COVID was one thing. You know, and all of a sudden I had time on my hands when we shut down for. Whatever it was, 3 weeks in North Carolina. And then as well, you know, like a lot of people just start buying exercise equipment and because you just had time on my hands. And then I had also hired Bryn Richard. She had helped me with some nutrition. And that was actually a big part of it, you know, that I cut sugar out. And I cut a lot of carbohydrates out for myself. I don't even eat any fruit, and a lot of protein and just, you know, what she was telling me to do. And so that was kind of my start with the diet, but really it turned out to that, the 2019 as we were getting ready, for the Nationals, and you know, all of a sudden this eight-way team, they're starting to pick up steam. I'm getting older and had just lazy fat on me, you know, I mean, it's just exactly what it is. It's just lazy fat. And I was like, man, I'm gonna have to do something to keep up with this, because I don't want to be that guy that's still on the team forcing my way in there, and I'm not, you know, and I'm like, oh, get this guy out of here. And so I just knew that if I wanted to do this again and win more world meets, that I had to change my gears. So I cut sugar. I stopped drinking for 7 months, and that also kind of was a catalyst that got me going. I went back to social drinking, but nothing like I was doing, you know, and you know, having three or four drinks a night, you know, when you get done with a day, you know, not getting smashed but still, it's a lot of sugar, right. You know? And
alcohol also, and you know, affects the way that you metabolize everything.
Weird, yeah. You know, you go slow. And so, and then just started really watching my diet. And of course, with my girlfriend Gina doing the exact same thing helps motivate you, you know? And now there's all this information, Bryn helping us with our diets and everything. And then I just started looking at what I needed to do. So I started running. I bought a very good treadmill and I started running and just being relentless on some type of cardio, running, elliptical, rowing, or sometimes just walking, you know, walking for long, like an hour, hour and a half of walking if I'm, you know, my knees were hurting me a little bit. And then I just did, I talked to you a lot too. And like, hey, okay, I just did a very simple thing of every day I'm going to do, between two workouts, like I'm going to do an upper body chest and biceps workout, and then I'm going to do a pull workout where I'm doing pulls, and I'll add into those days legs and abs on whatever day I kind of rotated them and out. And I was just relentless. I did it every day, and I was lifting heavy a little bit at first, and then I just kind of backed that off, and now I'm just lifting the same thing. I kind of have the same pattern of chest and biceps day, and then a pull day, you know, cable pull day, and then do some deadlifting and stuff like that. You can go down a rabbit hole, you know, there's a lot of things to do, a lot of good information out there, and I just stayed on it every single day to the point where now I'm fanatical if I don't do it. You know what I mean? Right. I feel guilty, and yeah, I'm like, way. Oh my God, you know, I feel like now I'm, you know, I feel like I'm putting pounds back on already, but I'm not. I just don't want those habits to come back. And that's all it is. It's just habit, yeah. Man. Sleeping, exercise, those are both, and eating, that's all habit. And it's like, oh, I'm a night out. No, look, if you force yourself to work all night, you'll definitely sleep at the right times, you know, and exercise too. It's just getting in there and starting. And once you start, you see a little bit of result. And then it's this, man, there's so much information out there, you know. Yeah. I listen to a lot of podcasts, like you know, we talk a lot about some of the podcasts, and then, of course, you know, just stayed on it, man, every day.
Yeah, you and Gina, you guys are definitely relentless. You know, I don't know how you guys do it as far as your coaching schedules and your training schedules and your you know, then your personal physical training schedules. And it just, you know, it seems like you guys are getting up super early. You said you're starting to do, or you've been doing for a while, hot yoga.
Yeah, been doing hot yoga. Yeah. And just trying a little bit of everything. You know what I mean? And so start early with that. And then I usually come back and I'll do a run in the gym in the morning. I like cardio in the morning. I prefer it. I'll do a cardio in the afternoon as well if I have to, but I prefer it. And then I usually come home and lift when we get done, you know, go make jumps. And, you know, the jumps, like, I get tired over days, but like how efficient we are here, you know, making 12 jumps in 5.5 hours. I mean, it's like you're hardly doing it. You know what I mean? It's just so quick. And how XP set up where, you know, between our team room and where the Packers are and the airplane and everything, it's a super smooth, easy thing. It doesn't really make me that tired. But after 5 days of, you know, you get into the 50, 60 jump week, you know, I feel it then mentally. I'm kind of like, ugh, you know, but other than that, I've been feeling pretty good, you know.
I think you're an anomaly. That's what I was talking to Gina the other day. I was, you know, just about how you do it, because I think that's one of the things that I struggle with now is the pain involved. You know, I think I've got you know arthritis just genetically, but you know, I've had the hip issues and that kind of stuff. But you're that's one of the other ways that you're an inspiration to me, is because at your age, you know, you're still just absolutely killing it. And I'm like, man, if he can keep doing it, you know, I can, yeah. I can at least try to keep doing it. And but I wanted to talk to you about your how you approach psychologically pain, mm-hmm. because, you know, it's something that I struggle with, and more I've been trying to learn how to dissociate, you know, to a certain extent. And I wonder if you do anything like that, or if it's just like you just, man, have, you know, some kind of mindset where you're just like, I'm going to shut it off and go.
No, like, I think the big thing for me when I have trouble with whatever, it starts for me, like, in this, I get a fear-based reaction, like, you know, okay, you know, am I done? Is this going to be something that's going to make me done? And then I kind of go down that path, you know, I'm like, oh, and then now it hurts. It's hurting me worse, you know.
Is it giving that focus and awareness?
Yeah, just thinking about it, right. Micro focusing a little bit, you know. And so I don't know, you know, that I will take ibuprofen, you know, acetaminophen, but I'm very cautious about too much, you know, I don't want to jack my stomach up. Yeah. I know, man. And so I think honestly that I get that and it goes away, like it's nothing permanent. And so I don't think that I have a whole lot, because when I do get stuff, you know, I don't feel like I'm that tough with it at all. I'm just like, you know, ow, you know, this is bad. You know what I mean? So I just don't think I have that much. And plus you've helped me with a lot of supplement taking. And that's another thing that I've been doing a lot of the, you know, taking oils and stuff that, you know, supposedly help with your joint pain. And I think it's working. You know, the X-Endurance stuff that we use, it seems to be working great. Hyaluronic acid, you know, take that. And then I take Athletic Greens every day. I mean, for 2 years, I haven't missed a day of that. Vitamins. But like we talked to, sometimes you go down a rabbit hole on supplements, and now I'm taking 15 pills. Yeah. Wait a minute. Yeah. And Bryn told me, she's like, hey, stop, you know.
Right.
It's just stop everything. And,
yeah, usually and when I pick up a new one, I'll try to get rid of it.
Yeah,
an old one that's not really, you know, having the effect that I'd like it to.
Yeah.
So on this, I'd like to talk about acting skills, because your acting skills are great, and especially when it comes to pain or discomfort, that's really when the acting skills kick in. And I can tell when there's only been like two times that I can remember out of the entire time that I've known you where you know, you've actually shown some, discomfort, or one of the times recently, I guess you were sick and I could just tell that you're usually the first person that's got your gear on, ready to go. And, I'm always lagging. Like struggling to catch up and you're lagging that day. So I know that, you know, if you're showing that, I know that something's really bad, but, I'd like you to talk about, acting skills and their importance and your approach with that.
Yeah. I think, you know, a little bit has to do with, you know, for me that, you know, being a dad, for one thing, was, you know, it's really easy to come home from whatever, jumping or whatever, and, you know, your kids want to, you know, play football or get on the trampoline. So easy to say, I'm tired, this. And it's always like, man, I never want to tell them that. You know what I mean? Like, they don't want to see the person they look up to, I'm tired all the time, you know? And I just, you know, is kind of micro focus on that one thing of like, you know, I'm not going to do that. So, you know, and not try to even show an attitude. Oh, okay, I'll do it. You know, and it's okay. You know, kind of switch your gears a little bit. And you know, I always think about it, everything could be a lot worse. You know, even though it's hard work, what we do, it's really hard work. But it's hard, fun work. We enjoy it, of course. You know, and I could be having to do a job, forced into doing a job by necessity that I just absolutely hate. And so that's part of it. And I'm not saying that there aren't times that I even come to training and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, and that can be a lot of different reasons. A lot of times it's saturation when we get deep into, you know, we're doing, you know, 150, 200 jumps a month, you know. Then I have that sometimes where, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, weather day wouldn't be that bad.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And but mostly I really love it. You know, I really love the drop zone and jumping and everything, and even fun jumping, you know, but nothing really compares to team training when you're team training, you know? So, yeah, I think that's it. I think it started with as a parent. I just was like, I'm not going to tell them that. And I don't want to tell my teammates that either. I have this thing where I don't want to cost the team one training jump for any reason if I can do that. You know what I mean? And, I didn't do that this year. I already had that, but try not to. And I think you just, you know, that's what I want to do, you know, and I don't really, at no time am I thinking I'm going to do this because I think that's what I feel like I should do, you know, like, be here, ready to go. Even the times when it was back in the, you know, the late 80s and 90s, when it was a little bit different scene there. You know, you could be team training in the land, say, you know, my weekend team, and then, you know, you bank on a bad a bad forecast in the morning and stay out at the bar really late,
right,
and then you're just like, oh man,
playing
training when you're when you got a bad hangover.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah.
Things that I don't ever miss, you know, as I got went into
times,
the pro circuit.
Yeah, my early days in the sport, and I don't do that anymore for sure.
Yeah. You look at it, it's sunny out. What?
No. So there was a change that I noticed in you when we it was back getting ready for the World Championships in Siberia in 21-22. You were in training. You were very aggressive. When we got to the world meet, I noticed a change in you. You had this calm that yeah. came over you. There was one time on a weather delay where you were pacing around, you know, like a caged lion yeah. kind of. But you seemed to keep everything at that point a lot more even keel. Can you talk about whether that's a deliberate philosophy of yours?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's like it's just slowing down, making sure that, you know, I get into that mode that every round is its own world meet, and it's the most important thing that I'm going to do, you know, in my whole life. This is the most important thing. And that has a nice slow down calming effect, I think, because our training days are just, you know what I mean? Down one jump, prepping one jump is such a nice feeling. And in the last few years, we've tried to do that during training, and we can't, it just doesn't feel right at home. It almost has to happen at the meet. You know what I mean? And like, our philosophy of, we got to Siberia super early. We were the first team there, you know, and kind of, you know, establishing ourselves there so that every other team that came in, we were already there. We understood how it worked. And, you know, it just was a nice time to just enjoy it. You know, and I think that's a big part of no matter what you feel. And if you say you're not scared going into any round one, you got no idea what you're doing. you better be. And but it doesn't paralyze you, because, you know, once we hit the air, that's your arena. And it's just like anywhere from that point. I mean, right. In Russia, several training jumps, we didn't see the ground. You know, there's a 1,500 foot overcast layer in there, you know, and so you're just like in your own world up there, you know. And we had that as well, where we had the big in a rainstorm. Russians get out ahead of us and pouring rain. We landed, you know, and then went back up, what, 20 minutes later or so. And so, yeah, I think it's mostly for me the same thing. Like, I'm gonna enjoy this, you know. And
that was cool. It was interesting for me to see, because that year I was, you know, I was down because of my injuries. I had to pull out. But it gave me the opportunity to be able to look at things from a more outside perspective and not just be focused on my own performance.
You absolutely were instrumental there, because you were standing over us, you know. And, you know, I remember, I mean, every dirt dive, we were like, what? Then you were helping us. And, you know, it's such a big thing. You know, it really, really is, man. Like, it's so easy to us, the eight of us, get down on the creepers. And, I mean, you know what I mean? We're in our own little world. But, you know, when you have somebody standing there like, yeah, this, this, and this. And then you, no matter what, you have the experience. You have the experience to know. And so, you know, everybody's like, whew. To validating what we're doing, you know, it's a big, big deal.
Oh, yeah, I didn't have to say much, because you guys are already locked in at that point. But, you know, it was cool for me to be able to just observe and, you know, see things like that, and see the, you know, your leader within the team. And it was interesting to see the effect that it had on everyone else. And I think it calmed everyone else down, and was, you know, because if you're excitable as a leader, people are going to look at that on the team and they're going to mirror that, you know. So it's, it was really cool. And then, you know, everything worked.
That
was
great.
Yeah, it was a fun experience. That was one of the most interesting travel experiences I had, getting all the way out there. That was crazy.
Yeah, man. I don't want to ever replicate that ever, man. That was something, you know.
Way. With the COVID and all the having to get the make sure your test was, you know, 20, on time to get out
hours.
There. And,
And Russia was fantastic, but like you say, it was just a nightmare during COVID. And I mean, it changed. Remember, it was like changed from just a sheet, and then on the way back, it had a QR code.
Oh, right.
Also remember, the one thing I remember about that was when they tested everybody at the meet, halfway through the meet, but at 600 people, and came back the next day, everybody's negative.
Yep.
Okay. If you say so.
Yeah, all good. So now I want to go back a little bit further and talk about the so I think we stopped talking about the conversation on the timeline as far as 8-way 4-way goes around 98. Was that the same time that you guys had the Edge team? And
yeah, we had the third team, the farm team, and to pull off of, you know, because, you know, just want to keep it going. And that was the Hills. Larry Hill wanted that. And so we brought in a team, and, you know, it's always hard. You know, those teams are always hard to maintain. You know, we were busy with our own teams, and just kind of keeping them in our loop was difficult, you know. But some of those guys, you know, got a lot out of it, and, you know, went on to do other big teams, you know. So, you know, I think it's a good idea, you know, having that kind of a little bit of a farm team, so to speak, you know. We did start pulling from that as well, you know, to the 8-way team and all those things. So,
and then what year was it where when you came out to the East Coast here?
In 2006, after the 2006 World Meet, Tim had talked to me about, hey, I'm going to build this huge tunnel. Do you want to come run it? And I was done with the grind of training for whatever 14 years. I'd been training on the U.S. team at that point. And so we came out here in October 2006. The tunnel broke ground February of 2007, and we flew in it in September of 2007. And so I was at the tunnel, and I was doing teams here with Tim and John, we brought Andy Honeybaum was here, and we brought John Eagle out and was doing four-way teams with us. And then we just kept there. Then we started doing some eight-way a little bit here and there, you know, and slowly bringing people in to eight-way. We could train it, you know, and we went through a few years there where the indoor meet was super exciting because you could train a lot of indoor, and the Golden Knights were training a lot of indoor. And so then we just kept kind of, you know, just dabbling in it. We weren't doing anything too serious. And then 2018, Nationals in Chicagoland, the hurricane was hitting North Carolina. I don't know which right. one, but it was sounding not good at all. And I believe the Army pulled them back, said, hey, you gotta come back, you know, and this is going to be a situation here for your families. And
yeah, and that was an internal struggle for us because I remember I was fully focused on the competition. I wanted to stay there, but I also had a support system, you know, back here for Lauren with Lauren's mom, Rachel, and her stepdad. But, you know, some families like Jesse and some other guys on the team, they didn't have that. So they wanted to get back and be with their families because it was supposed to be.
Yeah, it was supposed to be bad. Yeah, it was supposed to be bad. Like, and it was bad. I mean, they didn't, some places didn't have power for 2 weeks, right?
That's right. Yeah.
It didn't get that bad, but it was certainly, you know, bad. So we had, ended up winning that meet because that you guys weren't there, had to leave. And I think we did like a 15 average, 15 or 16 average, something like that. I mean, you would have blown us up. And then the 2019, I think then the Golden Knights started another rebuild. 2019, we kind of threw together a team and we did about 250 jumps. And it was, you know, starting to pick up some steam, you know, a little bit. And then
won the Nationals
in 2019, and then no Nationals in 20, and then the World Meet got pushed to 21. Yeah. So after that, we were jumping with the rhythm guys on there. It was Andrew and Steve were on, but then they won four-way, and we were trying to look at a schedule that would be reasonable to beat the Russians and the French. Well, we didn't even really know about the French at that point, the Russians, we thought. And they were already in. It was just not doable. So we went to Scott of Arizona and said, hey, can we borrow Nick and Mikhail, you know, and go to the World Meet in 8-way, and we'll let the rhythm guys just do 4-way. And they and Scott of Arizona was also a major sponsor. So we went out and did whatever, 4, 5, 6 camps out there. And so, you know, that went down, and that's when we did that combination with the Airspeed guys, because we already had Christopher on there. And
that was an interesting time because, you know, you had those kind of two worlds that were coming together, and actually we had a few different you know, thought process as far as, you know, our backgrounds and training was considered. You know, you had the airspeed side, you had the paraclete, and then you had a couple of Golden Knights.
Yeah, very nice combination, you know. And, you know,
but there were some struggles associated with that as well, too, because we all had those, differences.
We got into fights in that team. But all in a good way. I like mixing it up like that, you know. And as long as at the end of the day, you know, nobody's really angry anymore. You know what I mean? It's okay. You know, we all care, you know. And if you don't care, if you're just like, okay, whatever, and you don't say anything, well, you know when it's going to come out? At the meet.
Yeah.
That's when it's going to come out, you know, and it's going to end badly for you. So I thought we did a really good job with that team. You know, I think we really, you know, we wanted to strangle each other sometimes, but then at the end of the day, we pulled it together and
everyone wanted the same positive outcome and it came down to that.
Yep. Yeah. It's a close one though.
Yeah. You know, it was a fight for sure, but it was it was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And then that brings us to our current situation where we've got current members of the U.S. Army parachute team, the Golden Knights, that are on. And for me, it's super cool because it's kind of like it just reminds me of the old days. You know, when I was back on the team and being able to work with those guys is really cool. It's a really cool situation because they would like to rebuild an 8-way program, and they're able to get some institutional knowledge and experience here and, you know, bring that back to the Golden Knights.
Absolutely.
And it's beneficial for us because we're able to have that talent and, these guys.
They're super talented.
Incredibly talented.
Super talented. Yeah, even this last week when we jumped with our two alternates who are very talented skydivers, but they just aren't intimate with the dive pool yet in eight way. But still, you know, like just their energy was nice, you know, in the air that they were going for it, man. They weren't timid about any of it, you know. And when you see that, you're like, okay, you know, you guys are next, you know, for sure. They're going to be next. So
yeah, hopefully they guys, can. I was like, that was one of the funnest weeks I've had in a while because they brought that fresh energy and, you know, they were putting everything they had into it, and we had some fun
good
jobs.
Yeah, we had some good jobs. They weren't joking around. Once we got it going a little bit, it was going. You know, so yeah, they're going to be fantastic. Their 4-way team's going to be tough.
Oh yeah,
that's the next thing too for them. But I do see this as that. You know, they're going to just what you said. They're going to get this information. They'll get the right people. You know, it might take them a meet. You know, to really pull it off against even a team that we could throw together, because you could throw together and still pop up a pretty good average, you know, but it that's always just a throw together. It happened to the Knights after that whole time where we kept beating them just because we were coasting, you know what I mean? It was kind of inside of us. So, but I don't think it won't take them one meet. You know, once they get the right people and with the knowledge of those four guys that are jumping with us and Dave, and they're going to be a huge asset to 8-way skydiving in the world.
Yeah. And as long as they continue to have the support from the command they've had with this, commander, he's been incredible as far as, getting the team back on track after the previous command section. And it's, as long as they have that support, I think it'll be great. And just the fact that he's allowing them to work so closely together with us is, you know, says a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, they're great for the Army, in my opinion. And, they're fantastic for skydiving. You know, they're all wonderful guys and exactly what you would want out of a soldier as far as, you know, their quality of a human being. It's beyond reproach.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they represent well, and they have all of the the qualities that you look for there, for sure.
Yep.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about your experience as USPA National Director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So overall, you know, I did it for 10 years. It was, it was good. It cost me some sleep here and there, and mainly it cost me some sleep because I want transparency on it's a membership-based organization. And just because you get elected into that slot by other members, you know, that doesn't mean that you can't tell them what's going on unless there's some litigation over, you know, maybe a where we've, you know, taken a member's membership for a safety violation or something. you don't want to do that, but everything else needs to be completely transparent with them. And I wouldn't have said, I wouldn't say necessarily that it was an old boys club when I walked in there, but there were things about it that it wanted to be that. And what it, look, no matter what it is, the skydivers, you know, people, we're going to make mistakes, you know, that's okay. But when a board member makes a mistake, they have to, if it was anybody else, let's do the same thing. You know what I mean? And that happened a couple times when I was in there. And I got this sense that it was kind of like, ah, you know, it's not that big of a deal. Well, it's not, maybe seems like, it seems like a big deal to me. And if it were anybody else, it would be a big deal. But because it's a friend of ours, you know what I mean? And I understand that dynamic. I get that. But at the same time, you can't run an organization like that, you know, and I am just, you know, I made many mistakes there. I made many mistakes as the IPC delegate, where I, you know, was not kind to people in an aggressive way on some things. And I apologize for them. You know, I'm sorry that I used a cuss word in front of you, you know, and I'm not trying to do that, but you know, and same thing, you care about it, you know? So, but other than that, no, look, the organization itself, they're really, every board member there, they're really trying to do the right thing. And I'm talking about a few minor instances where it got the hair on the back of my neck up a little bit. I was like, got angry. All the rest of it, they're really trying to do the right thing. It's difficult, you know, because look, how many people vote in the election? 7,000, there's 40,000 members. People don't want politics and gossip. They got that at work. This is their leisure, man. They don't care. They want to have as cheap jumps as they can get. They want to have access and they want it to be as safe as possible. You know what I mean? And I think we leave it at that. And in our constitution, run a U.S. Nationals and select a U.S. team. The easy part, you know. But I think the rest of it, they don't want to get into it. You know, that's why people don't care. The only problem with that is that when something changes, people are like, what happened? Well, you don't understand how this is going. You care now because this affects you.
Right.
But this has all been out there. You know, you just don't look for it. And what you can't, if they're going to change some rule about tandem, you think they're going to call every TI in the country and ask them? No, that's not what they're going
to
do.
All right. Well, that's why, you know, we've got the elected officials
so,
there. You know, it was great to have you as an advocate up there as well for the competition skydiving, you know, part of things.
Yeah. I was chair of the comp committee and then the IPC delegate. And the same thing at the IPC. They're trying to get stuff done. IPC is different. They don't do with anything safety and training, nothing. They're just competition-based because that's how they make their money for the FAI. The FAI gets a sanction fee. The ISC now, they take part of that. That's how they survive, you know. And the pandemic was very difficult on the FAI. All their money stopped. You know, you couldn't have a competition. And so, you know, but so they're a little bit of a different animal. They're very competition orientated. And the same thing, all those people, they're really trying to do the right thing, you know, and sometimes they're wrong, but it's not from a lack of them. They're not trying to be malicious. I don't believe that. And in the USPA as well, I think the management last year or our last executive director, Ed Scott, did a fantastic job. Albert Berchtold doing a fantastic job. The staff at headquarters could not be more proficient, I don't think. I think they're great.
Is there any advice that you would have for people either currently or people that, you know, will have the positions that you filled in the future? Do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like I said, be transparent. You know, if you make a mistake, own it. It's the easiest way out. It doesn't require just saying, man, I goofed up. Sorry. You know, I'm going to try to never let that happen again. I think that's the easiest way to answer anything. Just own it. Nobody's going to be like, you know, they will if you try to hide it. You know, it's not my fault. No, it is your fault. It's okay. It's an accident or whatever it is, you know. And so I think being transparent and, you know, but, you know, I don't want to say listen to the people, but that's hard because, you know, sometimes the loudest person in there isn't maybe what, you know, is the right thing to do. And they can manipulate that because they're loud, you know, and it's, so you got to listen to Scott Ivers. And I think main thing, be a Scott Ivers, Scott Ive, be out there, you know, it makes it easier. You can kind of get a feel for what's going on and what people want. You know, it's not that hard. Like I said, they want to have fun. They don't want a lot of drama. They just want to skydive safe and as cheap as they can and have access to airports, man, I think, you know.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your insights with that. It's not something, you know, I just wanted to kind of, you know, briefly talk about it, but it's I appreciate you sharing those insights. It's interesting. You were within, what's it been the last couple of years? You've been getting into the Skydiving Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk some about that experience and, you know, how special I'm sure that was for you?
Yeah, it was super, super cool, man. Like, it really makes you, you know, inflect on what I've done. You know, like, wow, man, you know, I've done all that stuff. Because you still get in the now, and when you're team training, you're still kind of in the now. And I do have a tough time remembering dates and world meets sometimes. I have a lot of blend. I don't, you know, I'm like, you know, I have old teammates. We both do that. You could say something, it'll be like round three in the 2010 world meet. I'm like, what? I'm not wired that way. But when they called me, yeah, it was a pretty cool thing, man. I was like, wow, man. And then I almost had some anxiety. It's like, man, I got to make a speech. And so I'd like anything. I dirt dove. You know, I like did a lot of dirt diving on my speech. And but only with myself. And nobody heard it before I put it out there. And I think I did all right. You know, it's not something that I like. You know, public speaking's, it's difficult, you know. You know, I get forced into it, you know, at meets and things like that and being the delegate. But, you know, it's not fun for me. Some people might like it, but I don't. So, but yeah, it was a cool thing. And I was in a great class with Mike McGowan and Larry Hill you know, yeah, it was a super, super cool thing. Something I'll never forget and always be appreciative of, you know. For sure.
That's awesome. That event is really cool. The first one I was ever able to go to was this last one.
Uh-huh.
And it was really cool to be able to see Leslie Gale and Norm Kent and, you know, and others get inducted. And it was great to be there and see those speeches and just be around everyone that was there. And it was one of those moments where, you know, I kind of dreamt of, you know, being around all these people as a kid when I first started skydiving and, you know, reading all about them in parachutists and then being in there, you know, in the same room as all these legends, essentially.
Yeah, so many in there, you know. Yeah, it's for just fun jumpers, going to one of those events is a super cool thing. I mean, there is everybody there, you know what I mean, from all of them, manufacturers to competitors to photographers, everything, man. It's a very cool event. You know, the next one I think is Eloy, right? With some you know, some of our friends getting in there, you know. So it's a cool thing to do for sure.
Yeah, that is super cool. There's a few things I want to talk about before I let you go. I know you've been here for a long time. I really appreciate your time. One of them is the big way stuff. Like the one in Thailand. Yeah. Do you want to talk something about that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Thailand was a very, very cool experience. And it's a difficult one to replicate.
Just for the people that don't know, how big was that formation?
That was a 400 way. 400. And we were using 5 C-130s from the Thai military. And, you know, several Scott Ivers had made very good relationships there. BJ Worth, of course, probably the main one. Certainly Larry Henderson and several. You know, I probably don't know all of them. And the Thailand was, I think it was the King's birthday or there's some event, and they said, hey, we're going to we're going to put on a 400 way, break a world record. And I got hired to do, the Alpha team, and the Alpha team takes all the world champions that they hire. They're comped, and they, as people get injured or they're ill or they're just not performing, okay, I need this guy. Okay, you know, you from wherever, Russian team, French team, eight-way team, you go here. Right, so you know, I'm doing that. And then I took the people back. We had like a 40-way, and I was just jumping with the people, with like all the champs. And then as I started filtering out, then I had the people that were either ill, most of them, and some not performing. There were only a few not performing. Most of them were like ill. I mean, you know, you're eating street food, and you know, if you got 400 people, there's going to be somebody get dysentery in there.
Yeah.
And but a fantastic experience. I can't say enough good things about Thailand and BJ's, organization, skills and everything about him. He's another guy that I looked up to my whole life.
Yeah, me too.
And I learned a lot, you know, from him and, watching him organize and just organize the event and just be an ambassador, man. He's just really good at that. And, so I was on the Alpha team and it's going, and we were there a long time because there were a couple times where, okay, we're going to make a 200 way or something and, or two 200 ways. And all of a sudden an airplane's got to leave. So we're off for the day, you know, which I mean, we're in Thailand, you know, so just go have lunch and, you know, go see some sights. And it was super nice. And, as it started getting closer, we were getting, you know, on the 400 ways, we were probably on jump like, you know, like 10 or 12. And BJ was finally like, I've had pretty much everybody out. And he's like, you got to get in there. You're going to have to get in there. Just I want you to do whatever. So be ready. I'm like, okay, I'm ready. And so the second pullout guy is super sick. They're like, I'm going to take his slot. And so I take his slot. So it built to like a 398 or something. It was almost built. So I got to chuck out of this thing the second pullout. And dude, that was the most crazy visual, because you know what that's like when you see that kind of that hyperspace. Or but the crazy part was like all the cameramen, whatever, like 16 above it or 15 above it. And it looked like they were just like over the like a balcony looking down at it. And I was just like, whoa,
that's
that
crazy.
Was wild, wild visual. So then that guy came back. He was fine. And then on the next jump on the record, they're like, somebody's down. And they just had a piles of suits, red, white, or blue. And he's like, you need to get a white suit. So I go over and I get a white suit. And we're like going, because we were kind of in a hurry there. Some airplane had to leave, or it was always, you know, we had to be on their schedule, rightly so, because it was like, I heard $90,000 in fuel for one load.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the rumor going around. So so I pick up a suit, and I was in the Brits. I was in the Brits section. And I'm like, okay, I'm docked on you. And I'm like, who are you looking at? She's like, I'm looking at that guy right there with no dirt dive. And I'm like, Rob, who are you looking at? I'm looking at this guy. Okay. Okay, cool. So come out. And, you just stay in with everybody, you know, I just kind of stayed with all the people I knew. It's like, if all five of these people go the wrong place, I'm in trouble. But I kind of had my radio. And, I remember, you know, coming in there, and I had, Julie, a girl from the Brits on my left, and they were like, man, nobody looking around, just looking ahead, right? And you know, when a big way is built, it's still, you don't see anybody below it either. You know, you see people funnel out, like, okay, but there's nobody below it except cameramen, and it's just this quietness in there. And I remember shaking her. She's on the eight-way team, and the British eight-way team. I shook her. And I was like, hey, I think it's done. And she was just like, I'm not looking over there, dude. I am working right now. And it just had this thing. It's like, oh, and then you break off at like, you know, 7,500 feet. So you're tracking forever. I mean, you're not around any parachutes, you know, at all, because it's such a long track. And it has it that and the 300 way both. I remember specifically that when they announced it's a world record, had the same feeling of winning a world meet. Felt the same.
That's
like,
cool.
You know, like this connected performance. And certainly, listen, not to take anything away from it, but you know, there's train Scottiver is at a very high level. When you're training eight way or four way, you're at a high level of body flight. Like any one job on that 400 way, including the camera guys, that's not that hard of a task. You know, a lot of Scottivers could do any one of those jobs. getting 417 people to do it at one time, that's the trick, you know? And I think that's what makes it feel like a world meet, you know, that connected performance. I mean, we have to. And you're also almost always getting near the end. The pressure's on, you know. And
that just adds to the excitement. I'm sure, right?
And you're getting out at 26.5. You know, it's crazy, dude. You know, and we had just a couple people that tanked from oxygen. Their hose came out a little bit, you know, but the oxygen system, I can't remember the gentleman that was inside, but he did a great job, you know. And then Rusty Vest had the break-off procedure, and it was cool, man. Super cool. Yeah, that's a very fulfilling accomplishment. But I wonder sometimes if that 400 way, that's going to be a tough one to break, because C-130s, you're not floating around out there, you know what yeah. I mean? And then to get pilots that can fly them, you know, in formation. So, I don't know. It might stand for a long time.
Yeah, it has already. It's yeah. That was an incredible achievement, for sure.
Yeah,
yeah. What's your most memorable jump?
Man, you know, there's certainly the... There was in 97 in Turkey... you know, the big Kasev on a big tailgate, which is always cool. I think that, you know, we got into a situation late in that meet where the young French team, Maubouge, they caught us, right? They caught us, and we had like two rounds to go, and we went back to tie. We were putting it on them, like 5 or 6 points. You know, a very high-pressure skydive, you know, coming up to that ramp, and you're standing on the ramp. It's super windy on the Casa 235, and you're waiting for your green light. And, you know, like, you're just – it's very intimate because you're just standing next to each other. You're not like, you know, and you're in the door where you're, like, getting a grip and anything. You're just standing there.
Right.
And I remember Dan, you know, and I, you know, face-to-face and you know, just like, you know, him being like, have a good jump. I'm like, yeah, you too, man. You know, and we went off there and we shredded the last two rounds and beat them. So I think those two things were absolute pressure. You know, a young, very talented, hungry team, Maubouge, and they were on a trend, man. You know, because they caught us and they were rejuvenated a little bit. You know. And I think we were, you know, on the ropes a little bit. It made us nervous, and then we went out there and we just performed fantastically. And those are probably the ones I remember. But it really boils down to, like, I really kind of remember, like, the last meet a lot, you know? I mean, I really look forward. And even training jumps sometimes. We had some great training jumps a few weeks ago, and I was like, you know.
Yeah.
That's some fun stuff, you know. But yeah, I would say 97 world meet, and then a lot of it again has that intimacy of just being on the ramp, just waiting. You might be waiting 1 minute, you know, because you're not looking out. There's a guy doing that, you know. Yeah. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
And what an incredible backdrop that was too. Huh? Yeah, just being right that. Next to the ancient ruins. Roman
yeah.
City of Ephesus.
Yeah,
and,
wonderful, wonderful, good yeah. food. I think a lot of people got sick on the food, but I
yeah.
didn't.
Oh, yeah. I got really, really sick on that trip. Yeah. But I think that was probably because, you know, there was a night that we had off or something, and I went out into Kusadasi and
oh, yeah.
hit up Bar Street, oh, and yeah. I think I had some ice in my drink or something.
Yeah,
and I got, like, yeah,
yeah
I
the water.
Sick,
yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, that was fun. Yeah, so I think we can close it out on that. Unless there's anything else that you want to add, I really appreciate it. There's so much more I want to talk about, but we've already been at it for a while.
Yeah, it's okay.
And,
no, it's great,
might
man.
Have to take do a take two. But thank you so much for coming out.
Thank you,
brother. This has been really special. You've always been an inspiration to me,
thank
and it's
you. You
it's
too,
an honor
for
me to be able to be your peace partner, man. Yeah. I'm just looking forward to the next year and a half. You know, going to Norway and then to Israel.
Yeah, me too. All right. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. You know, we talked about it's like. I've had so much fun with you the last couple of years, you know, and like flying together. We're on fire right now, you know, so I love it.
Yeah.
Thank you, man.
Too. Thanks.
Appreciate it.